Every city in Canada should have an environmental group made up of local citizens. In Hamilton, we've been lucky to have a very knowledgeable and dedicated group of citizens that work hard to inform citizens of their rights and to make changes that help to control what global corporations can and can't do to their community. Today we speak to two members of Environment Hamilton.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
We're in the studio today with two members of Environment Hamilton. We have Dr. Linda Lukasik. Linda, you want to say something?
Sure. Hi. My name is Linda Lukasik. I'm the Executive Director of Environment Hamilton.
Thank you. And we have here also Don McLean. Don?
I'm actually a board member of Environment Hamilton and one of the co-founders along with Linda.
How long has Environment Hamilton been in operation?
We've existed since 2001. We were incorporated as a not-for-profit at that point, and we've been functioning ever since.
You want to give the listeners a little background as to why you thought you needed Environment Hamilton.
We were among the co-founders, and part of it was a frustration with a situation in which volunteers seemed to have to carry the load for environmental action in the community, and people got tired, they got worn out. And we saw that process taking place, and we felt that it was important to create an organization where people were paid to do environmental work. Not necessarily very much, but at least enough to live on so that they could work full-time at environmental activities.
And I think we also looked at the need for an environmental organization in the city that had a little bit more of an edge than any of the existing groups. So an organization willing to take on some advocacy work in addition to the typical public education outreach kind of work.
And your story, Linda, is kind of interesting. You mind telling the listeners?
Sure. You mean the Rennie story?
Already. How you got involved with that?
Yeah, it was actually a group of us. I ended up being the one who took on the task of swearing in the evidence, but it was a group of us from the east end of the city with concerns about Red Hill Valley and the state of the valley. And we found problems with an old leaking landfill site along the northern stretches of Red Hill. And we used our rights under the Federal Fisheries Act to basically collect evidence and initiate a charge-laying process against our own municipality. And what happened was that the municipality pled guilty to those charges in the courts, and they were fined a record level fine. And under the Fisheries Act, a lot of people don't realize this, there's a fine sharing provision. So when it's a private informant who brings the information forward, if there are any fines levied against the polluter, that individual gets 50% of the fine money. So we had made an agreement ahead of time that those dollars would be used to do more good environmental work. So part of the money went towards getting Environment Hamilton up and running, and we've still got a pot of money sitting in the organization in what we call our Environmental Justice Fund.
So that was a stroke that worked really well.
Absolutely.
Do you know of any other environmental agencies in any other cities besides? We have Environment Canada. Is there any other cities that do what you do?
There's similar kinds of organizations probably in most municipalities trying to do many of the same kinds of things we're doing. Our particular structure was partly modeled on the Toronto Environmental Alliance, but I think all of them are pretty unique.
Maybe we should start with all the different projects that Environment Hamilton does.
That could take us all morning.
Well, we have some time, so.
Okay. We're involved in a number of projects, most of them around climate change. We have a project called Passport to Hamilton, which encourages people to use the transit system by promoting the day pass that the transit system offers here. It's an $8 pass, and for $8, up to six people can ride the system all day long in both directions, getting on and off the bus. And what we've done to that is added a component where when you get off the bus, there's 150 locations that will give you a discount if you're carrying a day pass. So it's been a method of trying to get people onto the system that wouldn't normally be on the system, people to spend their vacation dollars in the city rather than leaving the city, And so it's been a boost for economic development in Hamilton. It's been a boost for transit use in Hamilton and for small businesses.
Another project that we've got happening is our Eat Local program. And again, links to climate change, because a big piece there is encouraging people to support local agriculture. And that project's been going now for a number of years. This is year three for our farm directory and farmers market directory map, which has been hugely successful. 40,000 copies, and pretty much all of them of the 2009 issue are out in the community now. That project is starting to shift now into focusing on local food procurement. So we're describing it as a closing of the loop, so that we are getting closer to creating a truly sustainable local food system. So we've got the farmers growing the food. We've encouraged Hamiltonians to get out there and purchase that food from the farmers. Now we're working on getting local institutions like our school boards and our institutes of higher education, the municipality itself, to start to pay attention to the food that they might be providing through their food service programs, and ensuring that a portion of that is local.
How close is that to the transition towns that we hear are starting? Dundas is starting a transition town. Is that the same sort of thing?
Transition towns has some of the elements that they're certainly in supporting local food procurement and eating local, eating in season, relying as much as possible on what the community itself can provide as a means of preparing for a situation that appears to be coming at us fairly quickly of very high energy prices, as well as the climate change threat that is threatening the whole globe. And so Transition Towns primarily is focused around increasing community resilience and their capability of dealing with those crises.
So they're self-sufficient. That's the
whole
goal,
that's right? The direction, yes, for sure.
Okay, how many more projects? We got three now.
One of the other ones that we're involved in is one that we've been working with the local community foundation for a number of years under their Tackling Poverty program. And it focuses on work primarily in low-income communities in Hamilton, particularly in the north end of Hamilton, along the industrial waterfront. And what we've tried to do with that program is work with those communities on environmental problems that they identify and which we try to assist with. So that's been involved with using the Environmental Bill of Rights to require industries to be much better neighbors than they've been in the past. We've succeeded in getting a number of changes to the conditions of life for the people in those communities. We got a new bus line brought into North Hamilton as part of that project. And it's got a lot of different aspects to it. It combines environmental efforts in terms of trying to improve the communities with advocacy work that takes on the sources of the problems and tries to make sure that they're brought into line in terms of legal requirements as well as just good neighbor kinds of situations.
So that brings us up to your newest project, which Linda can tell us about, the Good Neighbors Project.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, so this is all about environmental justice, and the Good Neighbor Campaign is another sort of arm of that approach that Don has described. With Good Neighbor Campaigns, and this is, we've just embarked on a project that we're pursuing in partnership with Toronto Environmental Alliance and Environmental Defense Canada. So it's an exciting opportunity for us. It includes three communities. So it's Hamilton, Toronto, and Sarnia, and more specifically the Amjanong First Nation in Sarnia. And they've got some pretty serious issues there on the edge of Chemical Valley. So here in Hamilton, with a Good Neighbor Campaign, it's a bit of a different approach. And it's not that we haven't been focusing on opening up lines of communication between communities near industry and industries themselves, but a Good Neighbor Campaign is all about, you know, really sitting down with industry and telling them very directly the kinds of impacts that communities are struggling with, and working with them so that they come to understand what the community's expectations are. And oftentimes, what you see in these kinds of campaigns and probably Ohio is the best place to look. Citizen Action, Ohio Citizen Action is a group down there that has provided all of us with some training and expert advice on their methods. And what they've accomplished down there very often are agreements between industry and community that surpass what community is required to do by government. So it's setting the bar even higher and working to get there. So for us here in Hamilton, on that project, we spent a couple of months with a summer intern, largely over July and August, actually knocking on doors in neighborhoods near the industrial core and asking people, how are you being impacted? What are your concerns?
That's terrific.
Yeah, it went really well. So we got a lot of helpful information from people. We learned some things that we weren't aware of. And we had an opportunity at the beginning of August. We made a direct request to Jürgen Schockler, the CEO of ArcelorMittal, Dofasco, and we had an opportunity to sit down with him and told him about the campaign and said to him, here's what your neighbors are telling us about your operation and what their concerns are, and we want to talk to you about how we can work to resolve these issues.
Can we just explain a little background on ArcelorMittal or ArcelorMittal?
Sure.
Hamilton's known as a steel town, and we're basically not. Nobody's working on steel right now. We've got a transnational global organization that bought out. What did they buy out? Stelco?
Both, yeah. U.S. Steel bought Stelco, and ArcelorMittal bought Dofasco. Neither of those new companies are Canadian companies. And when the economic downturn hit in earnest last fall, both of those companies basically decided that they could produce their steel somewhere else, something that wasn't really an option for companies that are Canadian-owned, as Dofasco and Stelco were in the past. And so we had a situation in which it looked like we wouldn't have any steel workers actually working in Hamilton, this being the steel capital of the country.
Now, ArcelorMittal, they're interesting. They're the largest steel producer on the planet at this point. And just in terms of the Hamilton operation, we saw some slowdown there over the downturn, reduction in working hours for staff there. The bigger hit was for U.S. Steel, where we did see the operation completely idled. We're now in a situation where a couple of weeks back, the company started up their blast furnace operation, started to make slab steel again on site. And then within the last week, we've seen all the coke ovens started up again. So we're now seeing both companies rebounding out of that downturn. Not sure how long that's going to last. So there are a lot of people back at work who had been laid off. But, we are now in a situation where we're still struggling with concerns over emissions and impacts on community.
Okay, so there's many things behind this approach that you're using. You're trying to get some sort of community involvement, get them aware of the community. But there's a lot of upset people. I went to the Labor Day parade, talked to some union workers, and they're saying our Canadian government actually put tax dollars into these companies to make sure that the jobs would stay here in Canada. Take the work and take it down to the States, and the steel's being made in the States. So what's going on here is just something that's sort of like a cast-off, a temporary part-time thing.
Yeah, I know on the U.S. steel side, there's a lot of concern over what we've seen happen, and certainly, folks involved in the labor movement have been raising those concerns. If you start to look at what's happening at Lake Erie Works, I've heard lots of interesting stories about the picket line and the kinds of experiences workers are having down there, surveillance that's being imposed on workers on the picket line that, certainly with a Canadian-based company, they hadn't experienced in the past. So, yeah, we're hearing those kinds of concerns.
They've been shut out of their jobs as well.
They have been. And there is a fear with U.S. Steel that the finishing side of the steel production is disappearing from the operations up here. Less so with ArcelorMittal. Arcelor is still operating, all of their various lines, and we're not seeing any sign that they're going to abandon that activity, at least not anytime soon.
Okay, so your approach to them has been on a different kind of level. You feel that they're going to be more aware of the local situation?
Well, I think the approach is one with a good neighbor campaign where you want the company to see that they're part of the community, they're part of a neighborhood, and that they have people living around them who are being impacted. And so we've worked a lot to bring those stories directly to the company. And, I'll give you, for instance, when we were knocking on doors down in the McAnulty neighborhood, standing on the front porch of someone in that neighborhood, you hear a lot of noise. And when you say to them, do you have any noise concerns? They'll say, well, you know, not through the day, which is amazing because the ambient levels are high. But then they'll say to you, but, you know, sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, I'll be sound asleep, and there's this horrible noise that we hear that wakes us up, and it happens regularly. So that's the kind of stuff that we found out, in addition to the bigger issues with the fallout and concerns about chemical exposure. And we were able to take those kinds of concerns to the company and say, hey, you know, we've got your neighbors telling us that you're waking them up at 2 and 3 in the morning.
Do you think they care?
Well, you know, we're using an approach here where we're giving them the information. So far, you know, after that first meeting, we had the company come back and ask us for more details and commit to taking some steps to try and to figure out what the problem was and whether the problem could be resolved. So we're going to keep on working on those smaller issues to see if we can see some small victories. We're hopeful. But again, at the same time, you've got on a parallel track the bigger problems that we are continuing to wrestle with, and those are the tougher ones.
Yeah, it's a small city taking on a global corporation.
Absolutely.
And it's just another example of the problems that they do in their own community. And this is part also a fallout, no pun intended. This is also part of the soot fallout that was going on for 2 or 3 years there.
Yeah. And still happening.
Still happening.
And still happening, yeah. Yeah. So it's a different dynamic now, because for sure, you know, when you start to have conversations with these companies about issues like environmental abatement, new pollution control systems, it's very clear now that the bodies that make the ultimate approval of additional funding or, you know, new equipment at the facilities is those approval entities are outside of Hamilton now.
Federal
and outside
level?
Of Canada.
Outside of Canada. Yeah,
yeah,
that's the problem.
Yeah.
So with this kind of problem, you got any suggestions on how you can work it from the streets, since that's what you're doing literally?
Yeah, I mean, we're encouraging people to, you know, call us, share their stories. I think, if anything, helping community members to realize that they've got a voice, and if they have a concern about how they're being impacted, that they should express those concerns. And, you know, oftentimes when we go to the door, people are sort of first suspicious of you when you're asking how they feel and what kinds of impacts they're experiencing. So part of the problem is that for far too long, people in these neighborhoods have been led to believe, well, what should I expect? Look at the part of the city I live in.
And it's a global corporation, and
that's
how can
right.
I
what
fight them?
What can I do? How can I fight them? And, you know, it's jobs and the economy, and we don't want to put people out of work. But our message to them is we can have the best of both worlds. We can push for a company that's operating as cleanly as possible, that's providing local jobs, and that's respecting your rights under the law. And that's the other piece. You know, we're always saying to people, you know, whether you live down up against the industrial core or out in a posh suburb in Ancaster, your environmental rights under the law are equivalent. So, you know, we encourage people to remember that.
Let's talk about the laws, provincial and federally.
Yeah, we've worked on not only telling people they have rights, but actually helping them enforce those rights and using the Environmental Bill of Rights and other legal mechanisms and regulatory mechanisms to ensure that real action takes place. So we had a company establish itself, an asphalt company, and the neighborhood was very concerned about what are the smells that we're going to have to endure from an asphalt company. And everybody's sort of aware of what happens when somebody's neighbor's roof is getting done with asphalt. So we encouraged them to write to the Minister of the Environment at the time the certificate of approval for the operations of that plant were being put in place, and ask for the ministry to impose rules on odors. In this case, a one odor unit, which means that if you can smell it past the fence line, it's in violation.
No kidding.
And the ministry put that rule in place, and that led to a lot of complaints, but it led to a lot of changes that meant that the relationship between that company and the neighborhood has actually turned into something which is fairly positive. The neighborhood and the company have an ongoing liaison committee that they work together on to address issues and problems, and the company has actually gotten involved in helping some of the neighborhood projects.
Could that be just promotion, greenwashing, a little bit of, because they lobby the government pretty extensively to get these large global corporations to get what they want, so.
Well, on the positive side, you know, what Don's just described with the odor unit limit is that once that sort of a requirement is put into place in an operating permit, it's legally enforceable. So it has teeth, without a doubt. And I'll give you an illustrative example of a recent case. We've got a big player that's come into town and set up a coffee roasting operation. Ministry went in because we've set a precedent in demanding that one order unit limit. So it's become almost an automatic thing in Hamilton now, where the ministry will roll a requirement like that into a certificate of approval for air emissions. So we've got a big player in town, known as Tim Hortons, that's actually fighting. They've appealed a certificate of approval that includes that odor unit limit. So it's going to be interesting to see what the outcome is there, but I think it'll be a tough haul for them, given that it's become a standard approach in this community to require that those certificates protect neighborhoods from odor impacts.
That's a new law. It's a federal law or provincial?
No, this is provincial, and it's not a law. These are conditions that the ministry can incorporate into licenses that allow a facility to operate.
I was told there was no environmental laws in Canada, and then 2001, there was some kind of environmental law set up. Is that true?
No, we have environmental laws in Canada, and we certainly could improve on them. But there's much more significant than they are in some parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've
and this is a good example. This one on, and it's a small example, but it's about whether or not a company can come in and do what it pleases and essentially destroy the quality of life of the people who live near it. That's to some extent has in the past been accepted as, oh, well, you live close to those companies, so that's what you have to put up with. And that isn't the case, and the law will protect you, but you have to actually be engaged in that process. And so we're involved both in using the legal mechanisms to make sure that citizens are protected, and also to try and strengthen those legal mechanisms.
And I think just in terms of environmental law in the country, we've had an Environmental Protection Act here in the province since 1972. And we've got newer tools that have emerged over time. So, with all of this work that we've been doing with legal rights and engaging people and commenting on Ministry of Environment approvals of new facilities at the provincial level, we've now got a provincial environmental bill of rights that's an incredibly powerful tool.
Okay.
And we tell people about that all the time. If you're trying to encourage people to make lifestyle changes when at the same time they're reading media stories about the huge contribution of the tar sands to the problem. So to me, it should be a no-brainer that's not a direction that we should be heading in, particularly given the understandings that exist, as Dawn's described, about the impacts of climate change and where we're heading.
Have you seen the length of the pipelines that are happening?
I've looked at some of the developments that are underway, and there's already some pipelines. Much of what we produce in Canada or we extract in Canada in terms of fossil fuels goes straight to the United States, and the new pipelines are certainly going to increase that amount going through. When you have that kind of production taking place and the emissions that are associated with it, it cancels out the activities of individuals. And if you look at the change in the numbers of the greenhouse gas emissions in Canada, we pledged under Kyoto to reduce our emissions by 6% from 1990 levels. It's a fairly modest pledge. We're nowhere near that. We're up about 28% at this point. But if you carve those numbers down and you look at them in households, the emissions have not gone up.
Really?
Where the emissions are going up is they're going up on the industrial side. At the household level, we're at about the same level as we were in 1990. They haven't gone down what we would like them to have done, but they certainly haven't been the main contributor to the pretty terrible position that Canada has now put itself in with respect to the global community, in which we basically thumbed our nose and said, well, we're not going to implement the Kyoto agreements, and we're just going to carry on the way we've always carried on.
Yes, and water, too, is going to be... You explain how there's drought happening in California. Water's a big part of this.
Water's an interesting one from the climate change perspective. In Hamilton, we've had a rather wet summer. So it's not so much a lack of water, but too much that we've been encountering. And it's, as we've looked into it, that's a prediction of the climate change models, that in Ontario we will see more extreme rainfall events. The numbers that have been coming out from federal and provincial governments indicate that the amount of the number of extreme rainfall events has been increasing 5 to 7% every decade since 1970. So this summer we had two what are being described as 100-year storms, and they're probably pretty close to that old standard. That old standard certainly doesn't hold up anymore within the new climate reality that we've put ourselves into, and that that those storms generated flooding of over 7,000 homes in Hamilton.
You want to explain what happens when we have these flash rainstorms, torrential rainstorms that comes down within 2 minutes in a sheet?
Well, Linda had some in her basement, so she may be
able to was one of the houses that was flooded, and you know, it's interesting when you sort of step back and think about that, and you know, so it certainly hit home for me in a personal way, because I'm living in a house that's never had a flooding problem in the basement, and my neighbors were in the same situation. Now, I was lucky. I only had a couple of inches in my basement. People on either side of me had 3 feet. And so what happens in a storm event like that is the system, there's such an intensity there, and there's just such a volume that comes down in such a short period of time that the system is overwhelmed. So, you know, I'm obsessed now. I have a rain barrel in my backyard, and I've watched in these storm events how within 5 minutes that rain barrel is full and overflowing. So
we can't deal with it.
The system can't deal with it. So you're hearing more and more municipalities that are paying attention in the way that they should be are talking about mitigation and adaptation, that we've got to start to pay attention to these problems, because the issue isn't going to go away. And in Hamilton, I believe we're particularly vulnerable because we've got a municipality admitting that we've got some serious shortcomings in our sewage infrastructure. So you combine that with the fact that we're dealing with these storms that are real doozies, you know. We're vulnerable, and I think I know sitting where I'm sitting, I'm really uncomfortable. I mean, every time there's an intense rainstorm, it makes me nervous now.
It's a danger zone.
It's a danger zone. You know, I've got a neighbor with young kids who are running down to the basement every time there's an intense storm because they're worried that the house is going to flood again.
Well, this is a floodplain, really. It's an area for the Red Hill Creek to go down to the lake.
Much of Lower Hamilton was wetland before the Europeans turned it into a city. And, you know, that's going to come back and bite us. But in addition, we continue to do things in the city which are making that situation worse. So this past summer, City Council approved two new big box developments, one at Centennial Parkway and the other one at 50 Road in Winona, which combined have over 5,000 surface parking spaces. You can't keep paving over the landscape and expect that you're going to be able to get control of the overflow of the rainfall events that are taking place, the storms, because every time you pave something, every time you build over something, that's a little less land that's going to be able to absorb things. And that's certainly one of the features of Red Hill and the expressway that was constructed there. We have 55 hectares of land that was once able to absorb rainfall, which is now pavement. That's has to have made things worse in terms of the situation in that valley. Now, that may not have directly contributed to the flooding of people's homes, although that's still, the jury's still out on some of the aspects of that. But it has certainly encouraged more paving and more building in the upper part of the watershed, so that has made the situation worse for the people who live in those areas. And in addition, that additional building has increased the pressures on our sewage system. Our sewage system is already, according to our sewer managers, working at over 100% of
How
its
old
capacity.
Is it? Most of North America, I read in a stat, is their sewer systems or infrastructure, as they call it, is 70 or 80% is old, 100 years old.
Well, it's certainly true in older cities like ours. And we have a combined sewer system as well, which means that the stormwater ends up mixing with the sewage. So when you get a lot of stormwater, you get a lot of overflows and backups and people's basements being flooded, not by rain, but by a mix of rain and raw sewage.
And it goes to the lake, doesn't
and,
it?
And that really makes an uncomfortable situation, obviously. And in terms of that expressway, when they put the thing in place, the decision to build it there was made 50 years ago, long before anybody tried to figure out whether you could build it there. And in both of the events that took place this summer, that road was closed by flooding. And it's a dangerous situation. You can, the flooding takes place extremely rapidly. It's a very short watershed. And it's quite possible for people to find themselves in cars that are suddenly in the middle of a river.
No, we had that. We had a mother and a child almost drowned because it came on so fast.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the dangers that are associated with this. And we're going to need to make a whole lot of changes. And they're not just government changes. There are a lot of individual changes. We have to abandon the idea that paving our front lawn so we have an extra parking space is a good idea. It definitely isn't. We have to start recognizing that the demands that we've made as individuals for more locations to put our cars are making this problem worse, and they're making other problems worse. They're making the climate change problem worse because we're now with two or even three cars per household, and out in the suburbs up to four and five cars per household.
So we've done great inroads with the buses getting into the North End, which surprisingly to me weren't there before, so that's helped. But we don't have a bus system up on the mountain, as we call it, where these new surveys have been built. People depend on their cars because they say they have no public transit.
Yeah, we've followed in general in Hamilton, the transit system is treated by council as a social service. So it's mainly aimed at low-income people. And it isn't really contemplated as a transportation system. Officially, if you read the policies, that's changed, and we have a new vision that will encourage the use of public transit. But in terms of the actual decisions being made at council with respect to funding of the transit system, it hasn't happened yet.
It's going to cost a lot more. It's going to cost them with the well, we just saw the emergency handout for people who couldn't get insurance or they couldn't cover the difference in their insurance. There's a big to-do about that. You want to explain that maybe a bit? Because this is happening all over North America and I'm sure other places in the world, but
yeah,
our society.
Yeah, in the aftermath of those rain events, you know, horrible situations for a lot of people. You know, I have neighbors who didn't have coverage that was great enough to cover the kinds of costs that they incurred when their entire basements had to be gutted after that storm event. So, I mean, people turn to the city, and the city, you know, the $1,000 grant to help people out, even with covering the deductible on an insurance claim, was better than nothing for a lot of people. But I know people who have ended up with a huge burden of additional debt because of what they went through in that storm event. And the worry is, you know, you go back in and you fix the problem, but what happens with the next storm event that comes along? And we're continuing to plan our communities, you know, as Dawn's described, with, you know, building more roads and more parking lots and
more cars,
more suburban development. You know, Red Hill, there was a development freeze on the upper escarpment that's now been lifted.
Wow.
And in my mind, you know, in light of what's happened this past summer, our municipality would be wise to put that development freeze back in place, because if anything, they're just going to contribute further to the kind of vulnerability we're feeling in the lower city and in some of these watersheds now because of the way the weather is changing.
Okay, so do you think City Hall staff get it? Do you think they understand that maybe planning for the past 100 years is not going to do it? Do you think they understand climate change is going to increase these flood situations? Not just by volume, but by number.
It's in the documents now. It's in the reports that they're putting out that they're saying, you know, climate's changing. And, you know, I suppose the cynic could say that's just an easy excuse for not having put in place the kind of infrastructure that would be necessary to accommodate this. But the change in infrastructure that's required in Hamilton is enormous. The bills are probably beyond the capacity of residents to pay for. So we're going to have to find a whole lot of mixed ways. We're going to need the rain barrels. We're going to need the green roofs. We're going to need probably cisterns. We're going to need permeable pavement. We're going to need a lot less pavement than we have now. We're going to need situations where people understand that putting a deck out back or a paved parking lot in the front is a bad thing to do and is going to make life worse for them in terms of flooding or worse for their neighbors in terms of flooding.
So for the people that have been damaged and going to get more damage in the future, I mean, who do they sue? They can't get insurance after the second time they've gone in.
That's right. And that the city has now introduced a program to provide up to $5,000 to people who have been denied insurance and can prove that they've been denied insurance coverage for sewer backup. That only covers for sewers. It doesn't cover for overland flooding.
Yeah.
And the cost to the city, the estimated cost to the city is somewhere between $6 and $8 million. But when the city asked for provincial assistance in terms of the flooding that took place this summer, they estimated that the damages to private homes were $50 to $100 million. So you can see that there's a great deal of the cost that is being borne by the homeowner themselves.
Yeah, and they can't do that. They can't keep this up.
Yeah.
It's going to get worse. So is there any thinking or planning in the works? Because this is just the beginning of what we're going to see.
Well, there's some thinking and planning in the works, but there's obstacles out there as well. Today we have an editorial from the Hamilton Spectator ridiculing the suggestion made by Environment Hamilton that we should have no net increase in paved surfaces in the city. And it's a very modest request. Really what we need is a dramatic reduction in paved surfaces. But we're simply saying don't add any more if you can't reduce that from somewhere else. And the newspaper considers that totally unrealistic, wants a reality check and so on. So
it depends
there's
on
a
the
lot
reality,
of obstacles from old thinking who haven't understood how serious a problem we're facing.
Well, that's getting back to climate change. A lot of people will not accept it. Even in when it's right in front of their faces, they think this is an anomaly. It only happens once in a while. It's not going to happen all the time. And all the unemployed steelworkers are making a big to-do in the press. They're busy making babies. Let's add more people to the local area after we can't keep up to the number of people we have now. That's one of the reasons they're building more houses. It gives developers a chance to say, well, we've got to have housing. We've got to house them somehow. Where does this stop? How do we turn it around? How do we wake people up to the fact that we can't go on anymore in the future the way that we've done in the last 100 years?
I'm optimistic we're going to start to see more and more people reacting and paying attention. You know, I think about Hamilton and how people have been impacted by these storm events. And when I talk to my neighbors, without me having to say to them, well, have you thought about this or have you thought about that? They themselves are realizing things are changing. And I think it's going to be a gradual awakening for some people, and it's a lot of people in the broader public who really haven't thought about these issues before. They haven't paid much attention or given much thought to climate change and what it's all about. But when it starts to impact them on a very personal level, like it has been, I think that's where you have almost a golden opportunity to start to encourage more reflection and more thinking and ultimately to encourage more action.
Well, there's different kinds of approaches. And Don and I were speaking earlier at the Labor Day parade about the jobs that could be created, because we've lost a lot of jobs, manufacturing jobs, steelworkers. We were known as a steelworking city, an industrial manufacturing city. The theory of how generations of families grew up is now stopped. That's complete halt, pretty much. So, Don, you want to elaborate on some of the jobs that people could be thinking about and maybe Hamilton could be bringing into the city?
Well, it probably requires a really quite substantial rethinking of how we work. For the economic system that we function in, fewer jobs has been actually one of the objectives, because fewer jobs means less cost to the employer. It has to pay fewer people, so the technological changes that are sought are ones which reduce employment. But at the end of the day, that also reduces the ability of the consumer the employee to buy things because it no longer has a job. There are lots of things that we've done in the past where we spent more effort and more time and more labor on producing things, and we've moved away from that. The changes in the taxation system would be helpful here. We tax labor. We put a huge cost on the fact that you earn an income. But we don't tax pollution in any serious way. We don't tax the destruction of the environment. We don't tax the loss of our forest lands. We don't tax the depletion of our soils. We don't tax the stuff that comes out the smokestacks and out the exhaust pipes of cars. And if we changed our financial incentives, we might see some significant changes in terms of moving towards a much more sustainable situation.
The world revolves around greed. That's how the world has been. That's how you get jobs. That's how the industrial sectors and the corporate sectors say, well, this is how we have to do things. This is how our society has to work. This greed will never go away. So we have to sort of tweak it, turn it a little bit. So those that want to make money and buy, you were saying the Tobin tax, flipping the same stocks.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that.
Well, this was a brilliant suggestion by a man who was a very well-respected economist and said we should have a tax every time somebody sells or buys stock. We have seen an economic financial system in which people are flipping stock literally every 10 minutes. And we have huge amounts of stock change hands every day in the stock markets. That process, which is sheer speculation, has nothing to do with improving the lives of anybody except potentially the gambling activity of the individual who's doing it, at minimum should be taxed. And if you put a tax on it, then it becomes something that, if I flip it 100 times today, it's going to cost me a lot more than if I just operate on the basis of changing those, making the selling, buying or selling of stock something which is occasionally occurring for much sounder economic reasons than what's going on right now. So it's a really simple kind of change that could be introduced. We obviously need changes to compensation where we have situations where people are earning an immense amount of money compared to the average person. Bonuses in excess of $1 million a year and so on. It would not be an unreasonable thing to simply have a maximum income and say, that's it.
Give it a ceiling and say
there's a ceiling, and that ceiling should actually be related to our minimum wage in a reasonable way, and probably an effort over time to bring those two closer together.
Do you think it might happen?
Well, it's going to have to happen at some level, and certainly there's more sentiment for it given what has happened over the last year and the amount of damage that's been done as a result of the casino activity that's been taking place in financial markets.
Interesting you use that term, that like a gambling addiction, and we were talking about greed and how to – okay, let them have an addiction, but let them have an addiction that's helping society, not just putting money back into their pockets. The amazing thing to me over these years is I watch this and I don't see a big sector of our population getting it. I mean, everybody's going to be in the same boat pretty soon.
It's an interesting idea, that an addiction, but put a charge on it. That's what we do with tobacco. That's what we do with alcohol. There are costs to the society from tobacco addiction, from excessive alcohol use and so on, and those costs need to be recouped. So if you can't actually legislate against those things existing in the first place, and we tried that with prohibition, then you tax them. Mm. So taxing the activity that's going on in the financial world would make a whole lot of sense.
I can't see it happening right away. Well, I can't see it happening unless there's a lot of grassroots push, a lot of push by the citizens that don't get to be in that market, don't get even to flip stocks. I mean, we have an ideal of society that isn't working. And it's been like that for, 200 years or maybe longer?
We're sort of drifting a little, I guess, a little bit off the topic, off the expertise of Environment Hamilton as such. But
well, we can get back to 3350.
Well, we had I looked at some interesting numbers this summer with regards to carbon dioxide emissions, and some people still haven't understood that we are doing something to the planet which is unacceptable and which is going to come back and bite us very hard. In Hamilton, there's about 1,100 pounds of garbage produced, municipal garbage produced every year by every person on average. And people have sort of gotten that, and they sort of understand we've got to compost, we've got to recycle, we've got to reduce that. We know what happens when that stuff gets away from us. We know what a littered environment we have. We know what's happening in huge amounts of plastic in the oceans and so on. So we've started to come to grips with that, and we've understood, I think, as a society, that's not acceptable. That 1,100 pounds, though, is very small compared to the amount of carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere. On an average, average Canadian puts 47,000 pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, 40 times what we do in terms of municipal garbage. And to think that we can do that and it's not going to have an effect is living in a dream world.
Okay, so how do they change it?
Well, that's a tough ride, and it's been a tough ride even getting through the whole process of recycling and composting and so on. But the first step is to recognize that we have a problem and that what we're doing is unacceptable and that we have to change it. And that's why the 350 number is so important, because it says in very clear terms, we have to get below that level. If we don't, we are threatening the very basis of human civilization. Life will go on this planet, but it doesn't have to go on with us.
It's not going to be survivable by people. Can you explain the tipping point and why they say the 350 is the maximum, and what other things are going to see? Right now it's exponential. It's kind of like the boiling frog. It's a little bit slow, but it's going to increase and accelerate really quickly, and we have more dangers than just the melting glaciers. It's the permafrost. It's the methane.
Yeah, there's a number of tipping points, and these are times where points in change in the atmosphere and change in the climate, when things change very fast rather than very slow. They flip into a runaway kind of situation. The melting of the Arctic ice, for example, is changing the Arctic surface from white to a different color. And the white surface reflects most of the sun's light. So about 95% of the sun's rays are reflected by a white surface on the ice, and we don't get much temperature effect as a result. When that ice melts and we have a dark surface, whether it's water or whether it's land, that reverses. About 95% is absorbed. So as it melts, you get more area darkened, more heat is absorbed, the temperature goes up. As the temperature goes up, more ice melts. As more ice melts, you get more dark surface and you absorb more heat and the temperature goes up. And it's a vicious circle. It just keeps on going. And once that gets underway, and many scientists believe we're already past the point of no return with respect to the Arctic ice. Underneath that ice, both in the oceans and in the permafrost on land, are immense stores of methane. And they have been frozen. They've been out of commission. They're not affecting our atmosphere. But as that ice melts, they're being released. And that's another huge tipping point, because methane is multiple times more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. It stays in the atmosphere a shorter period of time, thankfully, but it has a much higher impact on the greenhouse effect. There's a string of those things. We have the boreal forest in Canada, one of the largest forests in the world. There are now studies coming in suggesting that it may be becoming a source of greenhouse gases rather than a sink. So instead of planting a tree to reduce greenhouse gases, which has certainly been a good piece of advice in the past, when you have warming reach a certain point, and in the case of the boreal forest, particularly in BC and now into Alberta, where the pine beetle has exploded in population and is killing the trees, those trees are now releasing carbon dioxide. And we run a potential situation where that forest becomes not something which is helping us, but something which is making things worse. Same thing has been predicted for some time with regards to the rainforests in the tropical areas, that at a certain point, the drying out from the temperature will mean those forests are highly susceptible to fire. They'll burn, and we will lose the rainforest, and we will have that amount of carbon dioxide and pollution right. going into the atmosphere as well.
California is an example, and BC is an example this summer. All those trees burning just because they're so dry.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything you guys want to add? Do we cover everything?
I think so. Is it worth throwing in some mention of, this isn't directly related to 350, but I guess in some ways it is. One project that we didn't talk about yet today is another new one, and it starts to touch on some of the economic questions that you've raised and the job issue. We've headed in a new direction in embarking on a project that we call the Blue to Green Collar Transformation.
That's good.
So it's a green jobs, green economic development initiative. Has a couple of components. One is to start to give Hamiltonians an opportunity to come out and learn a little bit more about what green economics is all about. And then another piece is to start to look at what's the potential in Hamilton for green jobs coming out of the energy sector, green jobs coming out of, food production. What's the possibility for value-added food production in Hamilton? Could we be doing more? Could we be making ourselves a more resilient community by not only growing food here, but making value-added products that people need right here in our community? So we're just rolling that project out, and we've got a new partner we've connected with. It's an initiative called Blue Green Canada, and that's the United Steelworkers working in collaboration with Environmental Defense Canada. So we've been sitting down at the table with them and talking about how we can combine our efforts in Hamilton. They're in the process of bringing a full-time person to work in Hamilton on their project, and they'll be working closely with us. So we're really excited about what we might see there. How do we green the steel industry? How do we transform our local economy so that we're starting to think about good jobs, sustainable jobs, jobs that are linked with making sustainable products that we actually need, and moving away from that model that's caused so much of the problems that we're struggling with right now.
That's a great incentive. And some of the things I'm concerned with always, of course, is the poor, because some of those jobs you're talking about still require enough education to be an engineer.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's certainly a piece of what we're looking at as well. There's clearly a social justice element to all of this. And in the approach that we're taking to talking about green economics, we're acknowledging that we need to make sure that the job creation includes jobs that have where a person has a potential to earn a living wage, to engage in meaningful work, to have an opportunity for promotion if that's something that they're interested in. So those are pieces as well that we think are very important in the discussion.
I was just going to add that, we've been a steel town, and it's generated a lot of income for Hamiltonians and a lot of pollution as well. So it's been a both sides kind of thing. But if we're going to have, if we look at the global picture, if we're going to produce steel, if steel is going to be part of our future, it's going to have to be produced in a much greener fashion than it is now. And if we don't want to get out in front of that, steel production is not going to happen in Hamilton. It's going to happen somewhere else. So it's the kind of efforts that we're involved in terms of the Good Neighbor programs and the Green Jobs programs and the efforts to the North Hamilton work that we're doing to improve the relations between neighbors and the industry. They also have the other edge to that. This is also good for the industry itself. It has to change in those directions. If it doesn't change in those directions, the climatic realities and the fossil fuel realities are simply going to mean that we're not going to be able to do the kind of old-fashioned production that has happened in the past here. Steel mills in Hamilton have been two of the largest contributors on a national scale to greenhouse gas emissions of point source emissions, even in the last 5 years. So that has to change.
How can we transform those steel plants? What could we transform them into? Any ideas?
Well, I mean, you know, think about the fact that, you know, we're going to need to think as communities about energy and energy self-sufficiency. So why are we producing that steel? If you think about the downturn and how it impacted on the steel sector, it's because they were so heavily tied into the automotive sector and production of automobiles, producing steel for that purpose. So I know in the work that we've been doing, you know, we try to engage the steel sector players in discussions about, you know, are you diversifying? What are you making your steel for? How can we shift to a model where steel production is linked to production of things like windmills or other sorts of manufacturing initiatives that we could be tying right into that effort to develop energy self-sufficiency on a local level in communities across the country.
Yeah, and that one of the problems is we still can't get ourselves out of cars. They're still making more and more cars.
And we know how to get around that. We know how to solve that problem, but that's going to require a change in how we address transit. It's also going to require a change in how we do our planning.
Right.
And you raised earlier, we build suburbs and we don't have any bus lines even going into there. But building the suburbs in the first place is a significant problem because it means you've got to put pipes out to those things. You've got to extend all your municipal services. And if those suburbs are not high density in terms of their populations, we lose money as a municipality on every house we build in Greenfield areas. So we need to intensify. If we're going to change the population numbers, we need to have a much more compact community. But we need to do that in a way which doesn't diminish the quality of life and, in fact, improves the quality of life of people who live in the areas where the intensification is taking place.
Okay. We've been speaking to Don McLean and Linda Lukasik, both members of Environment Hamilton. I don't think we even covered all of your projects. You want to give out some information if people are interested and want to join and maybe get a job or do some volunteer work?
Well, Environment Hamilton has a website. It's environmenthamilton.org. And we have a phone number, 905-549-0900. We're located on Barton Street, opposite the Center Mall area. And we have a big demand for volunteers. We are engaged in some of our activities are entirely volunteer activities. The 350 work, for example, is an entirely volunteer activity. Some of our activities are supported by funding from various foundations and government programs and so on. So we're always eager to meet people who want to do something. We think we've created a model that allows for people who have an idea and would like to turn it into a project, would like to turn it into potentially a project that hires and employs people to do something positive in the community. They should come and talk to us because that's the kind of model that we've created to try and create a structure that people can work within to actually improve the environment.
It is an excellent organization because it does allow people to think about green ideas, and they're not by themselves. They can go to your organization and talk about it, and you can help them put it together. Okay. Once again, 300-350 is October the 24th, starting at noon in Gore Park?
Noon in Gore Park, that's right. 3 p.m. is the walk to the federal building.
Okay, and 300-350 is taking place all over the globe. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
There are two events happening in the community, October the 6th and October the 24th. Are you passionate about climate change? Want to do something in Hamilton? Then join Hamilton's first ever climate change speed greening event. When is it? Well, that's October the 6th, Tuesday at 7 p.m. You can meet 10 amazing people who are making a difference around climate change issues in their homes and in their city. This evening will inspire and motivate you to continue to play a positive role in your community. The location is the downtown McMaster campus, which is 50 Main Street East between John and Houston. That's Tuesday, October the 6th, 7 to 9 p.m., McMaster's downtown campus, 50 Main Street East. Admission is free, but space is limited. Email them champions at environmenthamilton.com. www.thecanadaproject.org. Coming up on October the 24th in Gore Park, that's right downtown at King and James, there will be a real motion for climate change. Join the 350 campaign. At noon, there will be so many things going on, music, demonstrations, instructions. And at 3 p.m., they walk to the federal building to deliver a message to decision makers. It's time to get back down to safe levels of greenhouse gases. The 350 campaign, 350.org. Contact the Hamilton branch by going www.hamilton350.com or call them at 905-549-0900. info@hamilton350.com.
Redefining radio.
Sync FM.